Good morning, everyone. And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rachel Long. I'm one of the Prairie members who has most of her voice this morning with hot water to help me out today. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, or your family structure. We welcome you no matter your age, your abilities, or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll have an opportunity to invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're presented by either a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Reverend Jane Espenson. And today, Margaret Carpenter will be presenting to us, and I'll be introducing her in a little bit. We now have a story for all ages. So children, feel free to come on up to the carpet. And Margaret Carpenter will be reading to us today. Okay.
I'm going to read a story to you guys about visiting day. This is about a little girl whose dad is in prison. And on visiting day, she and her grandma goes to visit her dad. Visiting Day by Jacqueline Woodson. Only on visiting day is there chicken fried in the kitchen at 6 a.m. and grandma humming soft and low, smiling her secret just for daddy and me smile. Take a look at her. She actually looks like my grandmother. She does. And me lying in bed, smiling my just for grandma and daddy smile. This is the little girl who's telling the story. Let's see what these smiles are about. Grandma's fixing her hair so she can be all pretty for her visiting day. And maybe daddy is already up, brushing his teeth, combing his hair back, saying, "Yeah, that pretty little girl of mine is coming today." With all the men around him looking on jealous-like, they wish they had a little girl of their own coming. That's your dad.
This is my own coming.
And that is a prison environment.
And a jail.
Yeah. Only on visiting day does Mrs. Tate come over when the sky is still pink, heavy with presents for her son, Thomas, saying, "Please, can you take these with you?" And Grandma taking the presents from Mrs. Tate's arms. Grandma's at the door getting presents. See? And shooting me a look that says, "You better not make a sound about Mrs. Tate not having money to take the bus there to see her only son." And I sit quiet, respectful. Because she's thinking that Mrs. Tate should go, but Mrs. Tate can't afford it. Only on visiting day do I stand patiently at the bus stop, holding tight to Grandma's hand until everybody's inside. They're all waiting. And I can tell you that we do provide buses for people who can't afford it, especially in big cities, to go visit their prisoners. And we are all passing around fried chicken, cornbread, thick slices of sweet potato pie until maybe you think we're gonna pop. Some of my favorite food. I can actually cook it too. But instead, I go to sleep and don't wake up again until the bus pulls up in front of the big old building where, as Grandma puts it, Daddy is doing a little time. Look at the barbed wire, razor wire. It's a prison. It's a tower. And only on visiting day do I get to tell Daddy everything that has happened over the month. While I sit on his lap and he pulls on my braids, smiling his big, me and Grandma have been gone forever smile. Laughing his big laugh, showing me and Grandma off to his friends, pressing peppermints into my hands and kisses against Grandma's cheek. This is what a visiting room typically looks like. I've been in many of them. Grandma says it's not forever going to be like this. They have to leave and look at the father's looking sad. Everybody's looking sad because they have to go. Time is up. She says one day, we'll be able to wake up and have Daddy right there in our house again. And we won't have to take long bus rides once a month and walk home from the bus stop hand in hand, feeling a little sad, already starting to miss Daddy. Grandma says, all it takes is time, a little time. And while we're holding out, waiting for Daddy to come home, we can count our blessings and love each other up and make biscuits and cakes and pretty pictures to send Daddy. Take a look. Take a look. And in the early evening, if there's a little chill outside, we can sit out back, bundle up in blankets, and make each other laugh as we make big plans when Daddy comes home again. And that's what they're doing, waiting for Daddy. The end.
Thank you.
It makes me think of my past, but I was very fortunate to not have anybody that was close to me in prison. I was very fortunate. And you'll hear that when I relate my story today.
Well, I get the opportunity to introduce Margaret Carpenter. And I have to tell you that I had to really take a pencil to her biography, because otherwise I probably could have been speaking for most of the time of the presentation. So I'm only telling you part of her biography here as far as her world of work. Ms. Carpenter is a native of Memphis, Tennessee, and she earned her bachelor's degree in ethnic relations from University of State of New York, or USNY, and her master's degree in urban teaching from Concordia University. And she also has Wisconsin teaching and administrative certifications. She held many positions in the Chicago Public Schools and also in the Kenosha Unified School District. She worked as a human relations officer specializing in discipline referrals. She worked as a teacher of both sixth and seventh grade science, math, and reading. She was a learning specialist, interim assistant principal, and then later a principal. She joined the Department of Corrections in 2007 as education director for the Division of Adult Institutions. And she has overseen efforts division-wide to help offenders in our adult system make educational gains in math, writing, reading, and other areas. In October of 2006, she was appointed to the Division of Juvenile Corrections as the division administrator. She's volunteered numerous hours for the Verona Public Library and in the Verona Area School District as an elementary tutor, and served on a high school committee that is focused on bringing underrepresented groups of students into advanced placement courses. She heads the Department of Corrections Adopt a School program, which provides tutors and mentors for students at the Sherman Middle School. She's coordinating a Department of Corrections partnership with REACH, which is Reach a Child Through Books, as well as a partnership with the National Council on Crime and Delinquency in order to assess the academic gains that youth make while they are in the corrections or detention system. So I welcome Margaret Carpenter today to speak on correctional education. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you.
It's actually an honor to be here, and Rachel has given a biographical summary of my formal training and current status. I would be greatly remiss if I did not provide you with another look at my background based on my upbringing, and I need to start this off by doing that. I grew up on 53rd and State Street in Chicago. The area was the Robert Taylor Housing Project. I spent 17 years in a drug-infested, gang-infested, crime-infested war zone. I grew up on welfare. My family depended upon food stamps and medical cards for survival. In 1978, my 18-year-old brother, who had just graduated from high school, straight-A student, was shot in the head in a robbery attempt. In 1984, a guy put a gun up to my head. He attempted to rob me. He attempted to rape me. He attempted to kill me by shooting at me twice. Once my mom and I witnessed a single homicide in our neighborhood. Years later, we both witnessed again a triple homicide. I have names for numerous peers who were murdered. When war zones are referred to, people naturally think of current places like Afghanistan or Iraq. However, I challenge that inner cities all across America are just as war-torn. Those environments contribute to poverty and illiteracy, and to a very large degree, those same environments feed the prison populations in America. I frequently tell my story to incarcerated youth and inmates in an effort to stimulate a sense of hope that they too can unlock doors, the doors of poverty and crime and illiteracy. I use my life as a living example to inspire hope and change. Because during my 17 years as a resident in the numerous Chicago housing projects, and one of the numerous Chicago housing projects, I was always just one step away from becoming prey or being forced into predatory behavior in an effort to protect myself. One scenario could have resulted in death, the other in prison. My key that unlocked the doors of poverty and crime was without a doubt education. A huge percentage of America's inner city population never succeed in unlocking those doors. Death and or prison become their destiny. So now I'm going to give you some statistics that relate to DOC. And currently, I'll just give you my status in DOC, Department of Corrections. I'm currently the acting administrator for the Division of Juvenile Corrections and the education director for the Division of Adult Institutions. I'm doing both jobs right now. When the governor changed my position, I had to resign my position as the administrator for juvenile corrections. And the current secretary, who's Secretary Gary Hamlin, asked if I would consider staying in the Division of Juvenile Corrections as acting administrator for an additional 45 days. And I agreed, because there are so many initiatives on the table to include the possible closure of a juvenile institution, which is a good thing because the numbers are low, which hopefully reflects the fact that crime is dropping with youth. And we do believe that is occurring because our serious juvenile offender population, and that is the group that commits certain types of crimes that automatically commits them to long terms in the juvenile system, it has dropped. So we think that crime is dropping. So, And I volunteered to continue to do the education director's piece because I didn't want to go back in 45 days and start at ground zero. And so I'm juggling two positions. It's very difficult. I'm exhausted, but it's part of my passion, and as you see. I'll give you some statistics, and I will take my time and flow through this. However, it won't be long and drawn out. So that'll give you an opportunity to ask questions, and hopefully I can provide answers. As of January 21st, 2011, just this past Friday, the inmate population for Wisconsin Department of Corrections, Division of Adult Institutions, is 21,667 inmates. The youth population for the Division of Juvenile Corrections is 605. 359 are in institutions, and 246 are on community supervision. There are 6,644 adult offenders on community supervision. Incarcerated adults are managed by the Division of Adult Institutions. Community supervised adults are managed by the Division of Community Corrections. However, youth incarcerated or on community supervision are managed by the Division of Juvenile Corrections, which is what I do. For the purpose of this presentation, I will concentrate on the inmates and youth in the institutions, because there's lots of data for all of the components. The statistics that I will provide will primarily reflect the adult population within the institution. I just have a very little that I will share about the juvenile environment, although I'm open to questions at the point that we have questions and answers. 47% of adult inmates lack either a high school diploma or its equivalent. 49% read below a ninth grade reading level, and 74% perform below a ninth grade level in mathematics. Another caveat that I want to add, but I'm not going to focus on it today, is that 70% of adult inmates entering prison have alcohol or drug abuse treatment needs. 24% are on clinical monitoring for mental health needs. 8 to 10% are seriously mentally ill with conditions such as bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and major depression. Those factors naturally present additional challenges for us in serving the inmate population. For the youth component, over 60% of youth read significantly below their grade levels, and 75% perform significantly below their grade levels in mathematics. And 65% of the youth have AODA treatment needs, and roughly 25% have mental health treatment needs. There are 19 adult institution sites. 18 have full-time schools. There are 16 adult centers. 3 have full-time schools. The 18 full-time schools in the adult institutions have the following: adult basic education to focus on basic literacy across all subject areas, vocation and technical education that prepares them for the job market. And there's the incarcerated individual program, which I will talk about in just a little bit. This is something that most people are not aware of. The Department of Corrections is a local education agency with a local education agency number, like every school district throughout the state of Wisconsin. I know that's not common knowledge to everybody. Each institution has a school code assigned by the Department of Public Instructions, DPI. There are 13 special education sites and 9 Title I sites. Now, in that number, I have included the three juvenile correctional institutions as well. The adult basic education program enrolls an average of 4,800 students per year and graduates about 1,050 per year via HSCD. As of July 2010, there was a waiting list of roughly 1,300 students for the adult basic education program. Under the umbrella of the adult basic education, the special education and the Title I programs are highlighted components. Adults and youth are assessed for various learning disabilities, and individual education plans are developed to meet those disability needs, IEPs. Special education funds are received and directed to the department's 13 sites that are special education sites to provide opportunity to support necessary accommodations as required by law. I oversee that component. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, provides funding supports to adults and youth who are under age 21 and without a high school diploma or its equivalent. This is Title I funding. The funds are used to focus on literacy across all subject areas and support graduation for those individuals who are delinquent and are considered at risk. Again, only the 9 identified Title I sites receive Title I funds. And there are plans that are required for how those funds are used in order to address the academic deficits that the inmates have and youth have. Third, the department also receives Carl Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act funding. The Perkins funding supports 62 vocational technical classrooms opportunities that are spread throughout the 18 adult institutions. The 62 classes come from 36 different vocational programs. During fiscal year 10, the department enrolled 1,054 student inmates and graduated 621. Last, but equally as important, there is the Incarcerated Individuals Program. It's called the IIP. We use lots of acronyms and corrections. It is a United States Department of Education grant-funded project. The grant financially provides tuition for student inmates to attend post-secondary academic courses towards an associate's of arts degree through MATC Milwaukee. Student inmates must be within 7 years of release to qualify for this program. They must be from ages 18 through 35 who have not committed certain crimes against minors and other violent offenses, and this includes sex offenders. Since the 2003 start of the grant, there have been 293 inmates served. Those served have successfully completed 1,580 credits, and 4 have obtained associate's degrees. The Department of Corrections employs 297 educators for the adult facilities. 60% of the teachers provide direct academic instructions to address literacy needs, and we're in process of redesigning our whole literacy approach. We're focusing on literacy across all content areas, and we're focusing on engaging the student inmates in learning. The remaining 40% provide vocational training, special education focus, and guidance counseling. The majority of the teachers are certified through the Wisconsin Technical College System for Adult Basic Education. The special education and Title I teachers are Department of Public Instructions certified. For the juvenile correctional institutions, all of the teachers are DPI certified. There's ongoing research to measure the impact of education on recidivism. Both the Department of Education and Bureau of Prisons have conducted individual research that shows that the more education that an inmate receives while incarcerated, the less likely that individual will go back to prison. Vocational training and acquired marketable skills have been directly linked to the reduction of recidivism. We pay $32,080 to house, feed, clothe, provide medical services, and educate an inmate per year. It's pretty high. Just brought the picture to kind of show you. One of the prisons with the money. The Department of Corrections leadership promotes some key beliefs and engages in practices that encapsulates the following points. Inmates are sent to prison as punishment and not for punishment. And we rigorously practice that. We must believe in a person's capacity to change his or her behavior. Inmates must be treated respectfully and with basic dignity. This can be done without compromise of the essential element of professional distance. Discipline must be consistent and fair. Inmates need legitimate opportunity to enhance their self-esteem and provide necessary tools to their toolboxes. There is inherent value in self-improvement programs such as education. Finally, 97% of all Wisconsin incarcerated inmates will return to society. That's a statistical fact. We want them prepared for successful reentry. The Department of Correction works hard to foster human treatment because we believe that human treatment in a positive sense is the greatest teacher for humanity. And that ends my presentation, and I'm open for questions. If I can just make reference to the victim piece, the Department of Corrections has an Office of Victim Impact that we spend a lot of time and energy in coordinating and paying attention to the victims of the inmates that we have in place. We work in terms of restorative justice greatly. So the point that you make is very valid that victims say that. And we do everything that we can to support the victim end of things, to include restitution. We are collecting restitution to a great degree from inmates who have committed crimes. So that's a very, you know, valid point that you make. But we also feel that if we provide inmates with tools to successfully reenter society, that we are hopefully reducing future victims. Yeah, and I know you do. So. It still exists today in that environment. As a matter of fact, I grew up on 53rd and State Street, spent 17 years there. Just about a few months ago, they were rating the most dangerous neighborhoods in the United States, and 55th and State Street is rated the second most dangerous neighborhood today in the United States. Today. And just one more point in reference to what you said in terms of how humiliating it is. I went to a service station yesterday on South Park Street, to buy gasoline. And my credit card didn't work in the normal fashion that it works out in Verona. And the directions weren't clear as to what I needed to do in order to make my credit card work in order to get gasoline. And I'm punching buttons in, and they're locking me out, you know? And I found that to be quite insulting. So some of that still exists even in this environment in the poor areas, even of Madison. And it is humiliating. I want to relate two stories, and I know there are other questions here. I go throughout Wisconsin's prisons doing graduations as a keynote speaker, telling my story, hopefully inspiring inmates to look at their lives differently, to make different choices, different decisions, and use the opportunities that they have while in prison to grow. And I was at Columbia Correctional Institution, which is a maximum institution, at a graduation, and one of the inmates was the student keynote speaker. And of course, the local reporters are there because they cover these things. It's positive stories. And the inmate was 25 years old, and he had been incarcerated for 8 years. So when he walked into prison, he was illiterate, and he relayed that story. And this was back during the election time, just before President Obama was elected. And he stated that it was very sad that he had to be incarcerated in order to learn how to read, which was a very valid point. And then he started talking about the state of the economy and all of the other pieces that exist in our society. And he says, and what's really sad is I'm incarcerated during one of the most important elections in the history of the country. And what's even sadder is if I would not have been incarcerated, I wouldn't even understand the impact of that or the economy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it was a very powerful statement. It was actually published by the local media. And then I'll tell the second piece as we close out. Well, the plan for education, remember that the whole Department of Corrections is a local education agency. So special ed needs are spread across the whole department. If a youth goes into an adult arena and is a special needs student, that youth is assessed for what his or her special needs are, and they are served based on those needs, even in the adult arena. My mom, who doesn't read very well today, always said that I want you to be better than I am. I want you to have better opportunity. And she said that religiously. And I was reading, you know, probably by age 3 or 4. I remember that, you know, and she pushed that because she said that was our true ticket to freedom from poverty and crime. And we were hearing that. That was important to us. But I also feel that the education system in the public school arenas, first in Memphis, Tennessee, and then in Chicago, in the black communities, I felt they were deficient. Very deficient, and they're still deficient. I know Jim last week talked about his joys and concerns, where he was dropping our kid off at Torquay, and the differences that still exist. Kid never came home with homework. And it's like, why doesn't he have homework? We're now transferring him to Verona. And I told him, you will have homework, and Jim and I will help you. You know, the differences are just vast. I remember feeling frustrated as a student, wanting more, you know, reading and understanding and wanting more from the school environment and not getting it. But my mom, you know, with her deficits, and my mom had 5 of us. She and my dad stayed together for 18 years before they separated. And I knew, and I was 33 when my daughter was born. which is rare, and that was by choice, because I saw my mom, when my mom and dad separated, I saw my mom as being in prison with us and having very little education, working two jobs as a maid. The connections have to be made, but the connections can't be forced. In my view, it's just the other side of it. There are so many things that we're not going to be able to change with the family environment. So we as a school need to do every single thing that we can to engage kids in learning. And when kids are walking into school doors, and I say this as a teacher, and they haven't been engaged, we are pushing them aside because many of us are inadequate in our abilities to engage them, so we move them aside. I've watched this happen over and over again. So teacher preparation needs to change. Yes, we do need to have a better family connection, but we can't just focus on that. We need to do everything we can within the education arena. I was a principal in a school, 840 students, 77% poverty. I took the school when it was a failing school. We turned it around by creating a community of learning within our environment and having that family component be brought in through helping parents to understand and educating parents, not forcing the process, because many times parents work two, three jobs. They just couldn't afford to be involved the way a parent can in a middle class environment. So we have to try and make adjustments for that. Not excuses, but adjustments for that. So, and that's just my piece, my take on it. You know, recidivism is dropping, prison population is dropping, you know, inmates are going back out into their communities, and they are connecting to jobs, even in this job market. So I think that it's not, and they're listening to us for the moment.
Especially in Wisconsin.
And the role of our prisons are not punishment. So I'm going to read that quote again to you. Because what we do is we send them to prison. And I'll read it exactly the way it says. That inmates are sent to prison as punishment. They're sent there, but not for punishment. So we remove ourselves from the punishment arena once they're there. And we try to help rehabilitate, help change, provide hope. So we truly believe that it's not for, we shouldn't be punishing within the system once we get them, because them being there is punishment. Well, everybody's aware that the OWI legislation came out back in June or July of this year, and that's another factor that's on the table that we have to address in terms of drinking and driving. And we are looking at right now within the community corrections environment as well as the institution environment, applicable, research-based, proven AODA treatment programs. And that has been our biggest challenge, that we don't have enough of that part of it. And I think that would be one route to take if you guys are looking at preventive measures, that maybe you even partner with DOC as part of community corrections and adult institutions, in how do we jointly put together a preventive program or have preventive programs in place within the communities. See, that's where it needs to be embedded more so than anything, even before they get to us, you know, get to corrections. How do we do that? I think that would be a good route to take, and I'm willing to talk about that more, and there are other people who are willing to talk about that more with you in corrections, because we've thought about how do we partner with our state, other state partners to deal with this issue of drunk driving prior to bringing them into the correctional environment, because that's going to be a key piece to keeping them from coming into corrections, mm-hmm. and then also keeping them from coming back after they've gone back out. Yeah, we have ALDA treatment. We have extensive ALDA treatment. Right. I just didn't talk about the treatment end. I just talked about the education end of it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. But there's a big treatment component.
I wish we could
go on.
We can
talk about that.
But we're going to have to stop, so please.
Could I make one final statement?
Okay. Final statement.
Yeah, I want to make one final statement in reference to what Nick had said, and I said I would do this in the end. I decided about 4 months ago that I'm going to law school. And I've started studying for the LSAT. And there's a reason that's driving this. It's not about career change. I'm probably going to be the first attorney to file a major lawsuit, class action lawsuit, against a major school district because they've graduated kids who can't read. And I end there.
Thank you for coming.